From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For 23 years, Firing Line has been the TV talk show liberals love to hate, and for all of those 23 years, it's been hosted by William F. Buckley Jr. On today's Fresh Air, Buckley talks about his role in revitalizing the right. Damon Wayans was featured in the film I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka, a parody of black exploitation movies written and directed by his older brother. Today, Damon Wayans talks about his stand-up act in which he does characterizations of the people he grew up with in the housing project. Rock historian Ed Ward looks at the evolution of folk rock, which he calls the most misapplied musical term since funk, and book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel by Israeli journalist David Grossman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In summing up William F. Buckley's contributions to conservative politics in America, columnist George Will wrote, "Before there was Ronald Reagan, there was Barry Goldwater. And before there was Barry Goldwater, there was National Review. And before there was National Review, there was Bill Buckley." In a biography of Buckley, John Judas wrote, "It is impossible to understand American politics today without understanding the rise of American conservatism, and it is impossible to understand American conservatism without understanding Bill Buckley's extraordinary life." Buckley is the founder and editor-in-chief of the conservative magazine National Review, and for 23 years he's hosted the TV program Firing Line. His new book, On the Firing Line, combines his reflections on more than two decades of broadcasts with transcribed excerpts of some of its most spirited exchanges. Buckley started the show in 1966 during a period he describes as the kid years.
I call it the kid years because the 1966 always evokes a period characterized primarily by the licentiousness of youth, whether they are going to Woodstock leaving the detritus of 700,000 people, whoever it was, or whether they're busting up political conventions, or whether they're throwing deans in the Charles River in Cambridge. They dominated the epoch. There was a sense of anarchy during the 60s. Its tributaries are diverse, everything from Vietnam to whatever. But I think the kid years is as neat and facile a designation as you can come up with.
This was good for you, right? It gave you a lot of targets to work with.
Yeah, there were an awful lot of programs on Firing Line that were devoted to one or another aspect of that kind of thing. One has to remember, those of us parochial enough to think that it was uniquely an American phenomenon, that in 1968 there were riots in Mexico, Rome, Paris, where de Gaulle was almost overthrown, London, Chile. So that there was some fever that was almost endemic in the globe. It was halfway through the Cultural Revolution in China. So it was a very, very turbulent period.
In your book about hosting Firing Line, you talk about the manifest evasiveness of many of the people who have been on your program. What are your techniques for dealing with that?
Well, the first thing, of course, to do is to spot it. As you probably know, there are formal rhetorical techniques by which one avoids answering questions. Probably the generic evasion goes under the Latin title ignoratio elenchi, that is to say, pay no attention to the counterargument, so that, for instance, if I accuse you of not having done anything to stand in the way of a particular riot on Tuesday morning, you will perhaps give me a lecture in which you denounce riots, so that you give the audience the satisfaction of denouncing riots, but not me the satisfaction of asking why you didn't do anything about the riot on Tuesday. That would be an example. What I do is take 8 or 10 distinguished people, Norman Mailer, John Kenneth Galbraith, and a few others, and show how they use these various techniques. By the way, I give several examples of how I engage in it myself.
Do you think you're very good at manifest evasiveness yourself?
No, I tend not to be, for this reason, and that is that since I'm not a politician. I almost search out difficulties. If I were a politician, my primary concern would be self-defense. And self-defense simply requires you to ignore answering a question to which the only answer you could give would be embarrassing. But since I'm not that, I almost look for difficulties in my own position and tend to relish them.
In the 1960s and 70s, there was a period when no comic impressionist could get off the stage without doing their impression of you. Who were among your favorites in terms of the impressions that they did of you?
I only heard one. I'm trying to think of his name.
You don't watch enough TV, do you?
excuse me? I don't watch an awful lot of it, but this one was terribly funny. In fact, I retained him to show off at a National Review function where he did Kissinger and Nixon and a few other people who were present. His first name was David, and I'm embarrassed I can't remember his last name. I think I know that Robin Williams does it, but I've never heard it. And Johnny Carson's done it in my presence, as well as when I wasn't there.
Was it David Fry?
David Fry, exactly. Thank you ever so much. He's terribly funny.
When you see somebody doing an impression of you, like David Fry, does it make you self-conscious? Do you feel like you've ever changed anything in the way you sit or hold yourself on TV because of an impression that you saw?
No, because a successful impressionist is primarily a characterist. If I were, for instance, able to speak exactly like, say, Harold Macmillan, and I spoke and said exactly what Harold Macmillan said, people wouldn't think of me as an impressionist. They would think that it was Harold Macmillan talking. So therefore, a successful characterist is someone who not only imitates your voice, but hugely exaggerates the idiosyncratic way in which you speak. So that, for instance, anybody imitating Henry Kissinger would not merely say, read a paragraph from a Henry Kissinger book or article. He would get into thoughts of a kind that made amusing or distorted his common conversations.
William F. Buckley is my guest, and he's written a new book called On the Firing Line that includes excerpted transcripts of his 23 years of the Firing Line program.
Well, it includes, but is by no means restricted to.
No, absolutely, yes, and I didn't mean to imply that.
Right.
I know your father was a multimillionaire who made his fortune in oil. You went to private schools in England and France when you were growing up. Did you ever regret being that set apart from other Americans during your formative years?
It's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of myself as being set apart. I suppose somewhere along the line, when you're 9, 10, or 11 years old, you recognize that you're traveling first class. But there wasn't ever any sense of alienation. I had a very large family, and large families tend to be egalitarian in their impact. It's almost impossible to have an affectation when you have 9 brothers and sisters, as I had. So that I didn't feel that alienation. Besides which, if you pick up your knowledge from reading, as I think most of us do, and you do read, it's inconceivable that you should not know about Dickensian life in the 19th century, or the life of the slums in the 20th century here and in Manila. The Gibbon knew an awful lot about the Roman Empire without ever having experienced it. So I'm always a little bit taken aback at the notion that because one has gone to private schools or to private colleges, one is AO ipso ignorant of other conditions.
There are a couple of stories which I suppose are true about how when you were 8, you wrote to the King of England demanding that England repay its war debt. And when you were 15, just during the first week at a new school, you wrote The Headmaster with your critique of the school. Assuming those stories are true, where did you get the chutzpah to do that?
Well, mostly ignorance, certainly in the first case. In the second case, the second story is largely apocryphal.
The one about the headmaster, writing The Headmaster.
Yeah. I've always expressed myself fairly freely, but with some sense of decorum. I don't interrupt the parade to lecture the bandmaster, which is a misimpression that people cultivate because it's kind of fun.
When you were growing up, did you have a sense of your father grooming you to become a certain kind of man, or to take a certain place in society?
Yes, I did. My father groomed, or tried to groom, all of his children to be intellectually honest and morally responsible. Having said that, I should say that he's failed spectacularly, because I don't consider myself as having lived up to the very high standards that he set.
You went to Yale, and I think right after getting out of Yale, though perhaps you started writing this when you were in Yale, you wrote the book, The Bestseller God and Men at Yale, in which you critiqued liberal education. Would you give us a very brief synopsis of your critique? I realize this is difficult to ask, but...
Well, my critique was based on the assumption that the purpose of education is to make discoveries, however tentative. If you discover, to take a simple proposition, that 2 + 2 = 4, you have to be very, very firm in dealing with people who say that 2 + 2 = 5. Now, transporting a simple mathematical proposition on over to other moral propositions, I maintain that the purpose of education, among other things, is to cultivate values which you think are correct. And that under the circumstances, to take, say, Das Kapital and the Declaration of Independence and say, as between the two, I decline to commit myself as to which of the two represents the values we seek to further, is an act of nihilism. Academic freedom, to the extent that it does that, is nihilistic. It says we cannot ever know. The formulation of John Stuart Mill, you will remember, was that as long as one person doubts a proposition, that proposition cannot be held to be true. I think that's utter and total frivolous nonsense.
Did you feel that Yale had failed you personally as a student?
No, I failed Yale as a student, because Yale and any university in the country is going to offer you more than you can possibly take from it, in the sense that it has such extraordinary variety. My brief against Yale was that it was not living up to its own charter. Its own charter was pretty explicit on its purpose, but the doctrine of academic freedom, as it reigned in those days and continues to reign today, simply says, in effect, nothing is knowable. And under the circumstances, all points of view are tentative, and it is a hubristic act to assume that any one point of view is better than any other. They use the metaphor starting equal in the race. Now, the paradoxes at Yale were that it was heavily oriented in favor of collectivism in its economic courses, with one or two exceptions, and heavily anti-Christian, with one or two exceptions, in its philosophical courses. Given the fact that the patrimony of Yale was Christian and also individualistic, believers in the market, that seemed to me a running act of hypocrisy that Yale needed to contend with.
After you graduated from Yale, you briefly joined the CIA as a covert agent. You were sent, I believe, to Mexico. Was this the fulfillment of a fantasy in any way?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, you later wrote spy fiction, so I wasn't sure. Why did you want to join the CIA?
Well, I wanted to join the CIA because I had been in the infantry in the Second World War, and a professor who was also partly a mentor of mine at Yale turned out to himself to have attenuated but nevertheless genuine connections with the CIA. And it was his informal job to try to recruit talent. As you know, there was a lot of recruitment in 1950 for the CIA. I don't know the round numbers, but he said to me, in effect, look, the Korean War is going to heat up. You plan to get married next month, which I did plan to do and did do. Would you prefer to go back into the infantry or do something a little bit more interesting? That was a very easy choice.
So you were stationed in Mexico?
Yeah.
What was your mission?
Oh, I can't tell you what my mission was. But my cover was that I was there to look after some investments of my father, who had lived there for 20 years.
Why did you quit? You only stayed 9 months.
I got bored. And I had published my first book, and various people were offering me jobs, so I signed up to work as an associate editor of the American Mercury, back before it cooked.
Do you think you could have been a good agent? Did you have a talent for the kind of work?
I don't think so. An agent has, above all, to be extremely patient. And patience is not my specialty. 98% of the work of CIA agents is equivalent to walking the beat. As somebody pointed out, we spend perhaps $1 billion a year collecting material that the Soviet Union can collect by simply going down to a magazine store at Grand Central. All of that requires very, very careful reading, very, very careful note-taking. So there's an awful lot of sheer tedium in CIA. That's not the kind of thing we read about in my novels so much, though I do make it a point to remark that phenomenon, or see in the movies, because you're always showing people shooting at each other and jumping off towering infernos. That aspect of the CIA life is probably 0.001%.
I want to talk with you more about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is William F. Buckley. He's just written a new book called On the Firing Line about his 23 years of broadcasts of the show Firing Line. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
William F. Buckley, Jr. is my guest. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of National Review and the host of Firing Line. He's written many books, including novels, plays, and nonfiction. His new book, On the Firing Line, is drawn from the past 23 years of his program. Is it fair to say that in the late 50s and in the early 60s, you saw it as your mission to take the right out of the hands of John Birchers and Klansmen and the Lunatic Fringe?
Well, to the extent that it is correct to say that the right was their property, for instance, the John Birch Society wasn't founded until 1959, so it was hardly in the hands of the Birchers in 1958. But what I felt was my responsibility to do was to do something to revitalize the right. The right was generally thought of as an aggregation of rich people who sat around in rooms and puffing their cigars, deciding how best they could exploit other people for the benefit of a privileged few. This wasn't my idea at all of what the vibrant conservative movement had done to create the most prosperous country in the world. So the answer is yes, that was my feeling of about what needed to be done.
What was wrong with the Republican establishment?
Well, it was strangely unvocal. There wasn't a single magazine that was both conservative and intellectual. There wasn't a journal of opinion. The Freeman wasn't that because it was a property of a foundation. The American Mercury was eccentric.
That's a magazine.
Fell into the hands of anti-Semites in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
So when we came around, there wasn't really another guy on the street, with the exception of Human Events, which was primarily Washington-oriented. So National Review began that whole, rather revived that whole movement.
Mm-hmm. National Review is the magazine that
you
started.
Yeah.
Now, it seems in a way that some of your positions were similar to the Bircher-type positions, but sometimes for different reasons. For instance, you sided with the white Southerners who didn't want to give blacks the vote, but for a different reason than, say, the Klan did.
Well, most people who defend the Constitution acknowledge that using constitutional mandates, people do good and bad things. The Constitution tells us that we can present pornography without any particular bar. It was nicely put by Irving Kristol when he said, "You can copulate on the stage in New York, provided you paid the minimum wage." Well, that's invoking a constitutional privilege. Now, the constitutional privileges were invoked for 75 years by the South to enforce Jim Crow, and for all intents and purposes, to prevent the vote under the grandfather clauses in Texas. This was a misuse of the Constitution. There were some people who said, well, let's simply forget the Constitution and correct the abuses, and those were people to whom we said, now, wait a minute, just as some people say, don't fuss with the First Amendment, even though it gives you pornography, we were able to say, don't fuss with the Constitution just to create a piece of legislation because you don't like Plessy versus Ferguson. I don't mind saying this now to you, because I've said it before, which is that I'm rather glad we lost that fight. I welcome the results of that disruption, but it was, in my judgment, a constitutional disruption.
Can I read something that you wrote during that period and see?
Write something I wrote in any period.
Okay, here we go. The central question that emerges is whether the white community in the South is entitled to take such measures as are necessary to prevail politically and culturally in areas in which it does not predominate numerically. The sobering answer is yes, the white community is so entitled because for the time being it is the advanced race. The question, as far as the white community is concerned, is whether the claims of civilization supersede those of universal suffrage. National Review believes that the South's premises are correct.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. That is to say, if you believe, as we have traditionally believed up until about 12 years ago, that you shouldn't vote unless you're literate, and if you are prepared to admit that the South was very heavily neglecting the education of black people, then under the circumstances you would have a much higher incidence of white people than of black people voting.
So you
have to remember that we lived then in an age in which people, including myself, contributed to something called the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Well, if you acknowledge that you want to advance colored people, you acknowledge that they weren't at that point as advanced as other people. And under the circumstances, they suffered certain disqualifications, which we all deplore, but which we can't assume were not so.
So you still don't believe in universal suffrage?
I don't believe in universal suffrage if it's defined as anybody who is biologically 18 years old is entitled to vote. Absolutely not. I believe there ought to be certain minimal reservations, which is what was also believed by John Stuart Mill and Thomas Jefferson and George Adams and anybody you can think of.
After trying to create a right that was a more intellectual right, I'm wondering what your impressions were of the new right that came to power with the election of Ronald Reagan, and if you identified with the various groups.
No, that wasn't a new right. Ronald Reagan was an old-fashioned conservative.
Well, I'm not talking about the president himself, but rather some of the groups that supported him.
Well, if you want to get into the taxonomy, I will. There are the so-called new right, then there's the neocons. They're very different. And then there are the traditionalists, and then there are the ecumenists. So did you want to ask me a specific question about the new right?
Yes, well, let's take one of the elements of the new right, say the Christian right groups like the Moral Majority. I'm wondering if you felt alienated from them and they from you. I think that you, to them, might have represented the hateful establishment. What I'm trying to clarify here is as someone who tried to kind of carve out a new definition of what the right was, when new groups and new points of view were added to the right, whether you felt that the right that you had envisioned was being changed for the better or for the worse.
Well, you would have to be more specific. One of one of National Review's responsibilities and one of my responsibilities, to the extent that I'm a figure in it, is to guard against accretions. If some fitful movement or political candidate or whatever thinks that he has the power to attach to the conservative position an obnoxious or eccentric or idiosyncratic position, we're there to say, no, where do you get off trying to do that? You can't say that it's part of the American tradition to deny, for instance, a black man absolutely equal rights with a white man. So in that sense, we are guardians of a tradition and are highly resentful at any attempt to pass off as conservative a body of thought that isn't in the least that.
Very briefly, in the era of glasnost, are you changing your attitude at all toward the Soviets, or are you suspicious of glasnost?
Oh, sure.
Oh, okay.
I changed my attitude towards who is running Russia at this particular moment. What I am extremely apprehensive about is any notion that this change is something around which we ought to refashion our foreign policy or our defense policy. We're talking about people who dispose of 12,000 nuclear warheads, most of which are aimed at us. And until that threat is eliminated, and until the doctrines of Lenin are renounced, all we have really gotten is a situation in which, recognizing their own reality, is they're letting up a little bit on the oppressions of their own people. But they pose no less of a threat to us now than they did 5 years ago. As a matter of fact, they pose a greater threat because their technology is more refined.
Do you think that being a celebrity has strengthened or weakened your political clout?
I'm not sure it would have any relationship to my political clout. Whatever political clout I have attaches to the plausibility of what I write and what I say in a number of media. If the whole world were converted to my own positions, then I'd have presumably zero clout on the grounds of sheer redundancy.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Nice to talk to you.
And my guest has been William Buckley, Jr. His new book, On the Firing Line, is published by Random House, and it's his reflections on over 23 years of firing line broadcasts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Mercer Ellington. He's led the Duke Ellington Orchestra since his father's death in 1974, and he's just produced a new recording featuring Duke Ellington's music called Music Is My Mistress. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Damon Wayans has acted in the films Beverly Hills Cop, Punchline, and I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. Coming up, we talk about his stand-up comedy act, in which the characters he plays are the guys he grew up with in the projects. Also, rock historian Ed Ward traces the evolution of folk rock from Dylan to the Byrds and Fairport Convention. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new novel by the Israeli journalist David Grossman. His previous book, Yellow Wind, was a controversial first-hand account of life on the West Bank. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. In Paris today, PLO leader Yasser Arafat said the organization's founding charter is now obsolete. Arafat made the comment at the end of the first day of a two-day visit to France. Roger Morier reports from Paris.
Arafat was being asked about the PLO's founding charter, which calls for the elimination of Israel. When asked if that charter was still valid, Arafat replied in French to say that the charter had fallen into disuse, that it was obsolete, and that he was elected as Palestinian leader to pursue another policy, that of living in peace in a Palestinian state side by side with an Israeli state. The question of the PLO's charter was at the center of discussions earlier today when Arafat met President François Mitterrand. The French leader asked Arafat to clarify the PLO position on the State of Israel with regard to the charter. At a scheduled news conference tomorrow, he will be asked again to state explicitly whether the charter is or is not still in force. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Morier in Paris.
In Lebanon, Army General Michel Aoun said today he may compromise with Muslim militiamen to end the fighting in Beirut while pursuing diplomatic channels to oust Syrian troops from Lebanon. The commander of Lebanon's mostly Christian army said he will consider lifting a blockade of three ports run by Syrian-backed Muslim militias to end 8 weeks of heavy fighting that has killed nearly 300 people. President Bush today urged the international community to speak out against the upcoming election in Panama. In a speech to the Council of the Americas, a business group, the president said it is evident that the Noriega regime is ready to resort to massive fraud in order to remain in power. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
President Bush expressed particular frustration with European silence on Panama. The Bush administration hopes to discredit next Sunday's elections if, as officials anticipate, General Manuel Noriega steals the vote. To focus attention on the elections, the White House has asked former Presidents Ford and Carter to lead an international delegation. In addition, the White House is now preparing its own group of election observers, though it's still not clear if either group will be permitted inside the country. President Bush also had some harsh words for the Nicaraguan government, saying the new election laws there stack the deck against the opposition. Warning this could create a crisis in the region, the president said it's now up to the Soviet Union to ensure progress toward peace. He challenged Moscow to end its military support for the Sandinistas. This challenge will be repeated when Secretary of State Baker goes to Moscow next week. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
The president today decided to approve American subsidies for the sale of 1.5 million tons of wheat to the Soviet Union. The sale is half the amount initially proposed by the Agriculture Department and backed by farm state members of Congress. The president's decision came after senior Republican leaders of the House and Senate urged him in a White House meeting to move ahead with the export aid. The countdown began today for the rescheduled launch of the space shuttle Atlantis. A faulty fuel pump halted the first attempted liftoff last Friday. NASA managers say preparations are going smoothly now that engineers have completed repairs. Atlantis is set to blast off Thursday afternoon at 1:48 Eastern Time unless bad weather interferes. The pressure is on for Atlantis to get into space and deploy the Magellan space probe toward Venus. If launch is delayed past May 28th, the Magellan mission will have to wait 2 years for Earth and Venus to again reach proper alignment. A jump in aircraft orders in March pushed up factory orders by 0.7%. The Commerce Department said today that excluding aircraft and other transportation equipment, orders fell almost 1%. In a separate report, the government said sales of new single-family homes fell 5.5% in March to their lowest level since January of 1988. On Wall Street, stock prices fell. The Dow Industrial Average lost 12 points, closing at 2402.86. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. At the beginning of folk rock, there was Bob Dylan, but others soon followed, Judy Collins and Eric Anderson, Jackson Browne and Warren Zevon when they were still just songwriters, and in England, groups like Fairport Convention and Steel Eye Span. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward retraces the development of folk rock.
With the possible exception of the term funk, probably no label in the rock and roll lexicon has been as badly abused as folk rock. It was a term you heard throughout the late 60s, used by record executives who, if they'd been honest, would have admitted that what they really meant was that they were looking for somebody who'd sell them as many records as Bob Dylan did. Dylan was, of course, the father of folk rock. Very early in his career, he cut a record, Mixed Up Confusion, backed by a rock and roll band. Dylan had never really meant to become a folk singer. He'd played rock and roll back in Minnesota and only became a folkie in New York because it was hip and it looked like the road to success. From the very start, he bided his time until he could plug in again and always encouraged rock and roll bands to record his songs. But the Byrds were a rock band doing Dylan songs. In an era when there seemed to be a next big thing lurking around every corner, the Byrds were proclaimed the kings of folk rock, and since they were based in L.A., it was only moments until the imitation started flowing into the stores.
Go away from my window. Leave at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not.
Turtles were merely the first and best of a nearly relentless flood of Los Angelinos who figured all you had to do was get a twangy guitar, a prominent tambourine, and a Dylan song, and you had yourself a hit. Dylan's true heir, the true folk rocker of this time, was an all but forgotten singer and novelist who'd married Joan Baez's younger sister. Richard Farina, with his wife Mimi, recorded 2.5 albums that alternated between acoustic music and a light electric instrumentation played by the same people who'd backed Dylan on his first electric sessions. Farina was literate, witty, and capable of writing some fine tunes.
No use crying, talking to a stranger, naming the sorrow you've seen. Too many bad times, too many sad times, and nobody knows what you mean. Ah, but if somehow you could pack up your sorrows and give them all to me, you would lose them. I know how to use them. Give them all to me. And there's no use rambling.
Just as he was beginning to be noticed, with the publication of his magnificent hipster novel, Been Down So Long It Looks Like Up to Me, Farina took a wrong turn off a cliff near Carmel, California, on his motorcycle on the way back from a book signing party and was killed. To my ears, nobody else in this country ever equaled the Farinas in their mixing of folk and rock elements. But while the top 40 here was groaning under the likes of Bob Lind and his elusive Butterfly of Love, and while scores of new Dylans tried their hands, clumsily, at electricity, folk rock was in the process of being perfected in England. Fairport Convention, a bunch of traditionalists who were also Byrds fans, got together in 1967 to really mix things up.
Before the winter fire, I will still be dreaming. I am. Who knows? Where?
When the lineup stabilized around their second vocalist, Sandy Denny, they wrote gorgeous original numbers, but they weren't afraid of the legacy of centuries either. They rocked Matty Groves furiously, but it remained the traditional ballad of a 15th century murder with a tune and words any scholar could recognize. By the time Fairport Convention got going, Bob Dylan had already had his motorcycle accident, which put him out of the picture for a while, and folk rock here was pretty much over. The movement continues, though, all across Europe and, it could be argued, in places like West Africa and anywhere else electricity is put to the service of tradition.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Stand-up comic and actor Damon Wayans wants to follow in his older brother's footsteps. His brother, Keenan Ivory Wayans, wrote, directed, and starred in the film I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. Damon had a part in Sucka, but he says he wants to someday write and produce his own films. He's appeared in Beverly Hills Cop, Colors, Hollywood Shuffle, and Punchline, and he co-stars with Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis in the new film Earth Girls Are Easy. Damon began his career on the comedy club circuit. This week on HBO, he can be seen in his first solo comedy special.
I'm just getting back from New York, man. I was hanging out with partners in New York, man. Some of them stopped dreaming. You know, my friend Simo hasn't had a job in about 5 years. He's just lazy, man. You know, I see him like, yo, see, what you doing for yourself, man? He's like,
nothing, man. I was collecting unemployment. But now they want you to come down there and pick the check up.
I found out one of my old partners, Larry's in jail now. Larry got 25 years for something he didn't do. He didn't run fast enough.
Your HBO special opens with two of your sons, and one says, don't sell out, Dad. Do the Whitey stuff. And the other says, no, tone it down. I want to stay in private school. Has that actually been a conflict for you, figuring out how much you can do that will still be commercial enough to get money?
No, that's not the conflict. I just think that, you know, the conflict comes from me not really being that angry anymore. You know, I used to be really hostile and militant, but I have a beautiful family, and, you know, that's the conflict. They make me so happy, you know, so I'm fighting within to still be a rebel, because I think, you know, if you don't have anything to say, then you don't need to be saying anything.
So has your material changed a lot since you're not angry anymore?
Well, yeah, I've evolved. I think so. You know, now I'm talking more about the family where I was before talking a lot about Whitey.
You do a lot of character sketches.
Mm-hmm.
Like the guy who does heroin and cocaine just before coming to your apartment to meet your parents and pick up your sister on a date.
Yeah, that's kind of true.
Is that based on something that happened or someone you know?
Yeah, I built a story because he actually was so high that he told my mother he sees where my sister gets her big behind from, and he thought he was complimenting her. And so I just thought, I found that very funny.
How old were you when that happened, and where were you watching from?
In the living room, and I was there, and it's just, you know, I always, my I was the kid who was very quiet and shy, but I watched everything, and nothing escaped my eye. So after the person left my house, I would do my own impression of them.
Oh, hey, what's happening, daddy-o? Say, I'm here to pick your daughter up. Yeah, Deidre. Oh, I'm taking her to the movies, man. Oh, we gonna go see Caligula. Say, this is a nice place you got here, Mr. Wayne. This is all right for the project. I especially like this colored TV you got here. Let me ask you something. About how much do that weigh? Look, now I know that this is your daughter. See, I understand that father-daughter relationship. I got 5 kids of my own.
You grew up in a housing project. Do you still have family there? Do you go back there at all?
Yeah, my brother just, with the success of Sucker, he bought my mom a house in New Rochelle. So she's in her world now. You know, she's got her own house, and it's 4-bedroom. And, you know, she used to need 4 bedrooms. Now it's just her and my father. And they just walk around looking at the rooms, talking about how they're gonna how they're gonna decorate them for my kids and my my sister's kids and stuff. So I do go back. I was just back in New York, and I saw my friends, and you know, I try and stay in touch with the people I grew up with. I think it's important.
Are they surprised that you're in comedy? Did you have a reputation for being funny when you were younger?
Yeah, but you know, it's just. I think I defied the odds. I wasn't the trouble that I got into as a kid. I shouldn't be where I'm at right now. I really shouldn't.
What kind of trouble?
Just trying to be, you know, one of the guys. It's all socioeconomic. There wasn't much to do. They closed all the community centers, so we invented our own games, like take the money and run, and we did things for fun that weren't fun, that were against the law. So those kind of things.
I remember when your brother Keenan was on our program, he was saying that he used to think of your mother as being kind of omniscient, that she always knew what the kids were up to.
Yeah, that's the scary thing. It's like I have friends who would like be able to bring home a whole stereo system and tell their mother they found it, a brand new stereo system. I couldn't do that in my house. You know, my parents were hip, and they knew. And my father sat me down one day and told me he knew what I was doing, and if I ever got in trouble, don't call home, because he's not coming to get me. You know, whereas, you know, my friends, I think they had a deal with their parents to give them a commission or something.
You were on Saturday Night Live for one season. Were you the comic who was always announced but was never on?
Yeah. That's me.
What happened?
Well, that was a weird year for everybody, not just me, but for Lorne Michaels. He was under a lot of pressure, and you know, because it was his first year back, and all the performers were jockeying for position, you know, and the writers were jockeying for position, and it was just really weird, you know. And I went through my rebel stage. And that was, like, the peak of my rebel stage, and I just felt it was a black thing. So I rebelled.
What did you do when you rebelled?
I switched characters on them on a live show. I was supposed to do it one way, and I decided I'm going to be artistic and do it another way. And Lorne Michaels came up to me afterwards. He says, John Belushi never did that to me. And I tell him, John Belushi's dead, isn't he? And for some reason, he told me, get out and don't ever come back.
Did you think you just ruined your whole career when that happened?
No. Lorne Michaels had said something to me, you know, when I first met with him. He said, with or without the show, you're going to make it. And I believe that. Mm-hmm. I still believe that.
You've been in several movies recently. You were in Colors, Punchline. I think you were in Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah, that was my first job.
Uh-huh, and in I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been finding it hard or relatively easy to find good black roles in films?
First of all, when you say a black, that's the problem with Hollywood, is the black roles.
Yeah.
Very limited with black roles. And when they think black, automatically it's stereotyped. And those aren't the roles that I want to do. I mean, I enjoy doing a street character, but I'll never win an Oscar for doing a street character because they think that's what I am anyway, you know? So I want to do something which is a stretch to me and a stretch to America, you know, and I think I'll have to write that myself.
I think you've said that white writers have a hard time writing convincing parts for black actors.
Yeah, that's because they label it black. And then a black guy comes in, and then automatically they put in their mind, you know, what a black guy is. And it's, hey, man, yo, you ain't behaving, happening, you know, and it's, and you read it, and it just makes you nauseous. When I don't mind someone writing a role, and then they say, okay, now you bring the blackness to it, see? That's cool. But when they write it black, then it's not for me.
Now you're in a new movie that's about to open, Earth Girls Are Easy.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of role do you play in it?
A black alien. I play an alien from the planet Jizala. And it's Jeff Goldblum, Jim Carrey, and myself. We come down here, our spaceship. We're like space truck drivers. Well, I don't want to give away the story, but we just have a great, wild, funny, funky time here on the planet Earth.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Yeah, I wish you the best. I look forward to seeing your new movie.
Thank you.
Damon Wayans' comedy special premieres May 3rd on HBO. He performs May 3rd through 6th at Chaplin's West in Detroit.
This is the most important night of my life, guys. I don't know what to do in my show.
Well, Dad, do the Leicester. No, that's why I got you 5 for Saturday Night Live. Be a commercial. Make one of your friends. I want to stay in private school.
From the palace in Hollywood, HBO presents One.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Well, we have today the news from Paris, you know, that Yasser Arafat, in a French television interview, asked about the Palestinian National Covenant, said it is null and void, the part about wanting to destroy the State of Israel. A big statement that had been sought by Arafat, among others, French President Mitterrand. We'll also be hearing from Cokie Roberts about why the United States Congress seems frozen, unable to do anything nowadays, and to talk with Tom King, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. He's called the man in the British cabinet who's responsible for running things there.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. David Grossman is an Israeli novelist and journalist. His firsthand account of life on the West Bank, Yellow Wind, was controversial because it was critical of Israeli policies there. Now one of Grossman's two novels, Sea Under Love, has been published in the U.S. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
I've been reading David Grossman's astonishing novel, Sea Under Love, for more than a month, fighting it off with swords and sticks and second thoughts. I'm too busy for a Moby Dick in which the whale is Hitler. A devouring metafiction that tells me how to think and write about the Holocaust, that reimagines simultaneously the death camps and literature itself, that somehow arrives by fairy tales, ghost stories, encyclopedias, Kafka, and nervous breakdown at the quality of grace. Grossman, a young Israeli writer as ambitious as a Gunter Grass or a Dostoevsky, ends up by seeming to forgive the Nazis. I'm not sure he has the right. We must never for a single moment forget to have mercy, says one of his characters. Otherwise, we're no better than they are. May their names be blotted out. Is this really true? Or does it merely wish away evil with a piety? If so, the piety's at least hard-earned, after every narrative strategy conceivable, after a nightmare deconstruction. This is what's left over once history's done its worst. Meet little Mamak, a child in Tel Aviv in the 1950s. His parents won't talk to him about the camps. He thinks of the Nazi as a beast in his cellar, to whom one feeds Jews. Then there's Mamak's great-uncle Anshel, who once wrote adventure stories for children, who survived the camps but whose witness is unintelligible, a sinister gibberish. Mamek will grow up, after a bout with madness, to become a writer. In Poland, at Gdansk, he talks to the sea. The sea tells him of Bruno Schulz, the great Yiddish writer murdered by the Nazis. He then imagines his great-uncle Anschel in a death camp. He is also imagining, like Cynthia Ozick in The Messiah of Stockholm, the lost manuscript of Bruno Schulz's masterpiece. Anschel, according to this imagining, survives in spite of himself. Like Scheherazade, he tells fairy tales every night to the Nazi commandant Nigel, in return for which, every night, Nigel shoots him. The bullets bounce off. The tales Anschel tells are based on his adventure series, The Children of the Heart, about superheroic kids living in the Warsaw Zoo who grow up into an anti-Nazi resistance movement. In turn, the real Nazi Nigel pretends in letters to his wife that Anschel's stories are his own, that there remains to him some decency. Nigel's consumed by Anschel's characters. He wants himself to belong among them. And these characters let him. Finally, while the reader's deciding whether to buy any of this, Sea Under Love turns into a glossary, an encyclopedia of the Holocaust, in which Anschel's characters are mixed with Grossman's characters, including Mamek and Anschel, abolishing narrative itself. All that's left is a prayer. None of this would work if Grossman weren't so adroit at speaking in tongues, if he hadn't put on the skins of all these ghosts to haunt us in the silence of our thinking about evil. Great literature, of course, is more than a confidence trick, although it's always at least a confidence trick. And I'm not sure I'll know for years whether Grossman's brought it off, whether this magic act may even be a masterpiece. But I do know now where he got the courage for his sympathetic portrait of the Palestinians last year in a little book called The Yellow Wind. He's imagined one way, his own way, out of hate.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Sea Under Love by David Grossman. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. The Washington Squares is a folk group that, in their words, continues the folk process, but doesn't play processed folk. Next time on Fresh Air, the Squares talk about giving up punk rock to play folk with a new wave beat. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz asks the question, can movie music played outside of the movies also be good music? He reviews a new collection of music from the films of Alfred Hitchcock by composer Bernard Herrmann. And critic Maureen Corrigan assesses the state of marriage as reported on the wedding page of the New York Times. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WUTC in Chattanooga, Tennessee. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Salad. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton, Ed Doherty, and Karen Impala. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.